So John 5, verses 1 to 15. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. Many years ago, when I was working in a hospital in South Africa, a mother brought to me her little boy who was blind. It was a Zulu family, and I looked at this boy, and he had cataracts in both eyes. He'd been blind from birth, so these were what you'd call congenital cataracts. And I thought, well, this is great. You know, it's a relatively simple operation. I mean, not for me, but for an eye surgeon to take out those cataracts. And he'd be able to see again for the first time in his life. He'd be able to see clearly. When I explained this, through an interpreter, of course, my Zulu was rather limited to questions like, "Do you feel pain?" And so on. So when the nurse with me explained that he could have an operation and he'd be able to see again, she shook her head, said no. So we inquired, well, why don't you want your son to have this operation? It turned out she was part of a religious sect, and their leader had said no surgery. And whatever we said to this mother, she simply refused to allow her son to have surgery. It was tragic. Here was this poor boy having to grow up blind because the adults in his life simply were not willing for him to have that operation. It is said, "There are none so blind as those who will not see." Not willing to listen, not willing to change. Willingness and unwillingness are key themes in John chapter 5. Jesus asks this invalid man at the pool of Bethesda, "Do you want to get well? Are you willing to be healed?" Later on in verse 40, Jesus has to say of the Jewish leaders, "You are not willing to come to me in order to have life." They simply were not willing to accept life from Jesus. Several years ago, there was an elderly man who I knew who come to church every Sunday. And sometimes I'd talk to him. He wasn't a Christian, but he would come every Sunday to church. And over the years, I got to know him. And on one occasion, I said, "Look, now, why don't you want to be a Christian? You know, do you believe Jesus is the Son of God?" "Well, yes." "Do you believe that he could forgive your sins and take you?" "Yes." And he admitted to me he basically was not willing. And I remember going to visit him in hospital. He was terminally ill, Went up one time and he was in a coma, and all I could do was just read some scriptures. I read John chapter 3 and hoped that in his dying moments he would yet be willing to believe in Jesus. I have no idea, even at the end, whether he changed. We need to be willing for God to help us. Last week we saw the importance of having a faith in Jesus that doesn't need to constantly be propped up. The people then wanted to see miracles. And Jesus said, unless you see these signs and wonders, you'll never believe. But we need a faith that doesn't need constant propping up. Well, today the question is this: are you willing for Jesus to help you? Are you willing for him to do something in your life? Are you willing for him to give you life, to change you? So let's look at this account of this invalid man. Firstly, we're going to consider the man Jesus chose to heal. The man Jesus chose to heal. It is fitting that in this chapter that has so much about our need to be willing, it starts with Jesus' willingness to help this man. And you all have noticed that instead of this being an occasion where an unwell person comes to Jesus asking for help, here we have Jesus seeking him out in order to help him. This invalid man at no point calls on Jesus for help. Rather, Jesus goes out and finds him. Jesus is in Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. We're not told which one. And Jesus went to the pool of Bethesda. And this has been identified as being in the northeast part of the old city of Jerusalem, near the city wall. In other words, it was out of the way. This was not the sort of place you would go to normally. It wasn't in the center of Jerusalem. It was out of the way, and yet Jesus goes there and he finds this man. And there in the shade of these covered colonnades around this pool of Bethesda were many, many sick people. The blind, the lame, the paralyzed. And this man was there with them. But we don't read that Jesus heals any of the other of those sick people sat there in the shade of that covered colonnade. He singles out just this one man. Verse 6, when Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Actually, the NIV is perhaps a little misleading here. It could equally mean Jesus already knew that this man had been there for 38 years. And it could be translated the way the NIV does it, when Jesus learned he'd been there. But the whole context of John, we've already had in chapter 1, Jesus knowing all about Nathanael, without anyone telling him. In chapter 4, we've had Jesus telling the woman of Samaria, as in her words, all that I ever did, without anyone ever telling Jesus. And later on in this very account here in verse 14, Jesus says to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." Jesus knew that this man was sinning. So it seems to me the whole context is more that Jesus knows this man has been like this for 38 years. And Jesus comes and finds him in order to heal him. Here was a man that most people would turn away from. You know, when someone has been in the same condition for a long time, people are far less likely to change their attitude towards that person. That they carry on treating him the way they've always treated him. He's the sort of person the world would just ignore. He's on his own. He says, "I've got no one to help me into the water." He's been there 38 years. He's probably an elderly man by now, unless he was there from boyhood. Even then, he's virtually middle-aged. And you know, the more we read about this man, the less likable he seems. He's not really a very nice character. He's full of self-pity. When Jesus says to him, "Do you want to get well?" instead of saying, "Well, yes," he just replies, "I've got no one to help me." There's a kind of tinge of self-pity in his response. And then when Jesus did heal this man, he doesn't even bother to find out who has helped him. Because we learn later on that he had no idea who it was who had healed him. I mean, it's astonishing, isn't it? You've been there 38 years, and someone heals you so you can now walk for the first time in all these years, and you don't even bother to ask who this guy is. And you know, when he did find out who it was who had healed him, he then went and told the Jewish leaders, knowing full well that it would get Jesus into trouble. Really, he is not a nice character. You know, the scriptures give us no good thing to say about him. And yet, Jesus found this very person. Jesus noticed him, Jesus spoke to him, and Jesus healed him. Jesus knew all about this man's sin, and yet Jesus still chose to heal this man amongst the many, many sick people around that pool of Bethesda. You see, this shows to us just how willing Jesus Christ is to help people. You know, if he was willing to help this man, he's willing to help anyone. And this is the glory of Jesus Christ. This is the compassion, the mercy that Jesus shows. This is why he came from heaven into this world. A world of darkness, of pain, of cruelty. And Jesus entered this world from heaven because he was seeking us out. Because he loves people. Have you realized that the lengths to which Jesus Christ goes to reach you? Because we can all identify with this man, can't we? We know we're not the nicest of people. And yet Jesus comes and finds this very man. Jesus came to seek and to save the one who was lost. This is the compassion of Jesus. People had left this man as a hopeless case. No friends. On his own, but Jesus finds him. Invalid for 38 years, self-pitying, and yet Jesus heals him. You know, whoever you are, whatever you have done, however long you have been the way you are, Jesus is willing to help you. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that absolutely wonderful? That he's come all the way from the glory of heaven, and he's come into this world to come alongside you. That's the glory of Jesus Christ. Let's move on. We've seen the man Jesus chose to heal. Secondly, the question Jesus asked him. The question Jesus asked. Jesus says to this man, "Do you want to get well?" Now, psychiatrists would probably see in this a kind of, you know, you won't improve unless you really want to. A bit like the joke, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one psychiatrist, but the light bulb has really got to want to change. Well, I don't think that is quite what Jesus means here when he says to the man, "Do you want to get well?" There's no indication in the account that the man secretly wanted to stay unwell so that he could just live off handouts. You know, he would have had people giving him some money or food, and, you know, there's no indication that he wanted to spend the rest of his days just sat there by the pool, you know, decade after decade and never getting better. In fact, he takes Jesus' question to be rather a silly question. "Of course I want to get well. Look at what he says in response to Jesus. Verse 7. Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. As if to say, well, of course I want to get well. It's just I haven't got anyone to help me get into the water. Now, we need to just unpack this man's reply a little bit. Because I think his reply betrays two things for us. Firstly, he thinks the only way that he's going to be made well is if he can get into the water first. Evidently, the people had this rather superstitious belief that an angel would come down every so often and stir up the water in the pool of Siloam. And the first person who managed to get into the water, once it had been stirred up like that, would be healed. And if you have an old AV, you will notice that actually there's a verse that talks about that, though this was a later edition that is not thought to be in the original. But nonetheless, clearly from what the man says, while I'm trying to get into the water, someone else goes down ahead of me when that water is stirred. So he has this superstitious belief, and he thinks that the only way he can be made well is if he gets into the water first. That's the first thing his reply tells us. Secondly, his reply really indicates to us that he doesn't want to mention the real cause of his ailment. You see, Jesus later on in verse 14 will talk about the sin that had caused this man to be an invalid. Verse 14, Jesus says, stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. The clear indication of what Jesus says there is that for this man, his condition was because he was sinning. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. And the man doesn't want to address his sin. And so he just takes Jesus' question at face value. He doesn't want to address the real issue here. Now, I should point out at this time that not all illness is a direct result of sin. I hope we're clear on that. You know, we're not to think if someone's fallen ill, oh, what have they done? If you just turn on to John chapter 9, I'll just read you the first three or four verses. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked Jesus, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. But this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. And then Jesus went and healed the man who'd been born blind. So that blind man was not blind because he committed some sin. Nevertheless, in the case of this man who is an invalid, it was because he had sinned. And evidently, the man knew what Jesus meant. And so Jesus simply has to say to him, stop sinning. And the man knows what Jesus means. So come back to Jesus' question. Do you want to get well? You see, Jesus' question was probing this man. If his sin is the cause of his condition, the question, do you want to get well, is really probing the man's sin. It's a little bit like when, in the Garden of Eden, God calls out to Adam. Remember, when Adam sinned, he and his wife, they hid in the garden. And God calls out to the man, where are you? Now, this wasn't kind of some grand game of hide and seek, as if God didn't know where Adam was hiding. You know, when God asks a question, it's not because God is ignorant in any way. It's because God is probing us. And so, when Jesus asks this man, are you willing to be healed? Jesus really is probing this man's heart. If you like, the question behind the question is this: are you willing to stop sinning? Can you see that? But you see, this man would rather hold to his superstitious belief than face up to the real question. And actually, this is typical of people who are superstitious. What's superstition? It's thinking that certain rituals, certain actions, certain words will be able to protect you from harm or grant you good luck. Don't walk under the ladder. Touch wood. Be the first into the pool of Bethesda. You know, not only are those sort of things absolutely powerless, they can do you no good and they can do you no harm at all, but actually they keep you from addressing the real issue. You do this or that to stop bad luck, but you ignore your relationship with God, who alone can really bless you and protect you. Do you see the point? This is why superstition is not only useless, it can do you no good, no harm, but it diverts you from addressing what you really should be thinking about, which is your relationship with God. You know, people are so skilled at avoiding the real issue. The human heart is absolutely skilled and, you know, would make a most wonderful barrister in, you know, or politician in avoiding this question and just going down the line it wants to go down. We will do anything rather than seek God or admit that we're wrong, far less would we change our ways. For 38 years, this man has laid there, holding on to his superstitious belief rather than facing up to his sin. 38 years. It's astonishing, isn't it? 38 years with superstition instead of facing up to the sin that he was committing. Now, not everybody will be hiding behind superstition. For other people, it's their religion. They will rather follow rituals of their religion than repent of their sin. They'd rather do the right thing than do what is right. For other people, it's not superstition or religion, it's blaming others. They won't face up to their own failings, but instead blame other people for the trouble in their life. And so they hide behind this screen of just blaming other people to avoid facing up to their own sin. And so Jesus' question probes our hearts. Are you willing to be whole? Are you willing? Is it all about, are you willing? How long are you going to hide behind your superstitious beliefs? How long are you going to hide behind your religion? How long are you going to hide behind this facade of just blaming other people for all the ills in your life? Don't be like this man. 38 wasted years of hiding behind a screen, while all the time he was harboring his sin. Don't be like that. What a waste of a life. Absolute waste. But you see how probing the question that Jesus gives to this man is? Are you willing to be made whole? Are you willing to get better? Are you? Are you willing to face up to what's inside? Are you willing? We've seen the man Jesus chose to help. We've seen the question Jesus asked. Thirdly, let's look at the authority that Jesus shows. The authority Jesus showed. Jesus doesn't probe any further at this point. He realizes the man has no idea who he is. He takes Jesus to be rather stupid, asking a question, do you want to get well? Why else am I here? Okay, so Jesus demonstrates to this man the authority that he has. This man doesn't know who Jesus is, and so Jesus is going to show this man his power. And he speaks to this man. He says, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. Now that's quite a thing to say to a man who is lying there, an invalid, has been there for 38 years. His muscles must have wasted away from lack of use. And here's this man saying to him, get up, pick up your mat and walk. Sounds cruel, doesn't it? How can you tell an invalid man that to carry his mat, at least you could carry it for him? But this man realizes he's healed. He's never felt strength like this, probably in his whole life. At once, he picks up his mat and walks. It's utterly astonishing. Just imagine his surprise. He's been there 38 years and he's suddenly walking. Suddenly his muscles are strong, and whatever it was that had caused him to be an invalid is completely cured. Now he ought to have stopped to thank Jesus. But he doesn't even find out who it was who'd healed him. He ought to have stopped and thought about the authority that this man had, who could say, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. But instead he just walks away. Well, as he's walking, the Jewish leaders stop him. Because it was the Sabbath and he was carrying his mat, and these Jewish leaders had all their minutiae, little laws, well, you can't do this, you can't do that on the Sabbath. And one of those things, you could not carry your mat. Listen to how the man replies. Verse 11. The man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk. You know, in the words that this man says, he's practically telling himself what he ought to think about Jesus. He says, the man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk. But you know, even though the man is saying, someone has healed me and someone has told me to pick up my mat and walk, the man doesn't join the dots. It's like he ought to have seen that Jesus, who had healed him, had this authority from God. And Jesus, who had the authority to heal him from God, would also therefore have the authority to tell him what he can do on the Sabbath day, namely, pick up his mat and walk. It's a strong contrast to the perception shown by the man in chapter 9 who'd been born blind. Let me just read to you the response that this man has when he's challenged by the Jewish authorities. Chapter 9, verse 30. The man, that is the man who'd been born blind but now healed, he answered the Jewish authorities, now, that is a remarkable thing. You don't know where he, that is Jesus, comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. You see, this man in chapter 9, he's got a bit of perception. He's been healed. He was born blind. He's probably been blind a similar number of years as this invalid has been an invalid. And he recognizes that having been healed, it was done by the power of God. Whereas this man in chapter 5, he talks about a man who has made him well, but simply does not see that that man is from God. Well, if he doesn't join up the dots of his own words, surely he ought to listen to what the Jewish leaders ask him. Verse 12. So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" Isn't that the question? Who is he? Don't you want to know who it is who's just healed you? Yeah. Of course, they want to find out who it is so they can get him for telling the invalid man who's now walking to carry his mat. This invalid man who's now walking should have said, "Good question. Who is he? He not only told me to carry my mat, but he healed me." It's like that they're all ignoring the elephant in the room. I'm aware some of the children may not be familiar with that phrase. Imagine there's a big elephant stood right here. Right? You got that, Joya? There's a huge elephant. I can't even reach the top of its head. It's so big. And no one's talking about him. We just step round him, but we don't mention the elephant. And this is exactly what's happening in this conversation here between the man who's been healed and the Jewish leaders. They're simply not addressing the big thing, which is he's been healed. Who is it who has healed him? They don't say in verse 12, "Who is this fellow who healed you?" They simply say, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick up your mat and walk?" There are none so blind as those who will not see. Surely this man ought to be bursting with the question, "Who is this man who has such authority?" Well, maybe the man needs a bit more time to think it through. Okay? And most people are not so quick-witted as the man in John 9. Let's give him a little bit more time. And Jesus gives him a little bit more time to have the right question in his mind. Because later on, Jesus does find him. And he's had time to reflect on what the Jewish leaders have asked him. Who is this man? He's had time to reflect on what's happened to him. Jesus had slipped away, but then Jesus finds him. Verse 14. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man has had time to consider Jesus Christ, even though he doesn't yet know his name. Is the man going to ask Jesus, "Who are you?" That's what the blind man asks. Turn on to chapter 9. Again, Jesus finds the blind man again. There are lots of parallels between these two chapters. So chapter 9. Verse 38, Jesus heard that they had thrown the blind man out. When Jesus found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking to you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshipped him. That's a true response. That's a true response to the authority of Jesus Christ. But the man who'd been an invalid, he just goes away and he reports Jesus to the authorities, knowing full well that Jesus will get into trouble for apparently breaking the Sabbath. Jesus goes to the heart of the matter at this point. He's given the man the opportunity to raise it with Jesus with that question, "Do you want to get well?" But this man is either unwilling or simply doesn't perceive the real problem. And so Jesus says to him, "Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." Those are terrible words, aren't they? Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. You're well again, but be careful. Be careful. Unless you stop sinning, something worse may happen to you. Possibly a further ailment. More likely, I think, Jesus is referring to the final judgment. Because there are parallels between this and what Jesus will say later in chapter 5. So often in John's Gospel you get a sign and then a discourse relating to that sign. And Jesus says to him, get up, and then warns that something worse may happen. The voice of Jesus, that authority saying, get up, and then the possibility of something worse. Look at the parallel in verse 28. Do not be amazed at this, verse 28, for a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice, and that voice will say, get up. Verse 29, they will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done what is good will rise to live, and those who have done what is evil will rise to be condemned. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. How would you have responded at this point? Here's this man, he's been healed, and now Jesus says to him directly, stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. How would you have responded at that point? What would you have said? What would you have done? You know, I think the best response this man could have made would have been this. You have healed my body with the authority from God. I beg you, change my heart too. You who have made me to walk again, make me to live properly again. You who have the authority to heal my body, would you heal my soul? Is that what you would have asked Jesus at this point? But the man doesn't. You see, this man is not willing to change. He just goes and reports Jesus. He's such a contrast to the man who'd been blind, who falls down and worships Jesus, who wants to know who Jesus is, who believes in him and worships him. The man here is simply unwilling. Don't be like him. Don't be like that elderly man I told you at the beginning, who even though he came to church every week and believed in his mind the things that were said, but was simply unwilling to change. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you. Who are you like? Are you like the man in chapter 5, or are you like the man in chapter 9? Are you stubbornly refusing to admit you're wrong and to ask Jesus to change you? Or are you one who Jesus has opened your eyes and you say, Lord, and worship him? Because we're all one or the other this morning. Every single one of us. We're either stubbornly refusing to change or we're saying, Lord, change me. Who are you? And each of us must answer before God this very moment. And cry out in our hearts, Lord, change me. I don't want to waste my life and face an eternity in hell, stubbornly holding on to my sin. I want to be changed. I want to be clean. I want to be able to see. And I want to be able to worship you as my Lord and my God. And so you enter into life. Which are you this morning? Let's be quiet for a moment and then I'll pray.